With Rose Scott, I'm Dennis O'Hare.
Dennis, as it often happens, cancer is in the headlines today. Lauryn Hill was a 19-year-old college basketball player. I believe she played for Mount St. Joseph.
Mount St. Joseph.
And she inspired many when she managed to get in a game despite inoperable brain cancer. Well, she passed away earlier today.
And earlier this week, a federal appeals court in Florida issued a ruling that would make it tougher for smokers and their families there to collect damages from tobacco companies. Now, all of this comes as the head of the Atlanta-based American Cancer Society is preparing to leave. He's going to retire. Dr. John Seffrin has been CEO since 1992, but he's been involved with the American Cancer Society since way before then, and he joins us now in our studio. Dr. Seffrin, welcome. Congratulations on the retirement.
Thank you, Dennis. It's great to be here.
Let's start with the appeals court ruling, and we're not going to ask you to talk about the legality of this, but this was the case of Earl Graham. His wife, Faye, died of lung cancer back in 1993, and Earl Graham was eventually awarded $800,000 in damages from Philip Morris. Well, now the appeals court has reversed that, and what it said was that other plaintiffs cannot use the findings from an earlier class action suit when they bring their individual cases against tobacco companies. The implication is that now, from now on, you got to show how tobacco use affected you individually. You can't just sue them based on, okay, everybody knows smoking's dangerous. How difficult is that going to make it for people to recover from tobacco companies, and does the Cancer Society have a position on this?
Well, yes, it will make it more difficult, and I think it would be an accurate statement to say that really is a technicality. If you look at the legal history with respect to asbestos, it's a very different situation, and clearly what's different from asbestos at the time that that occurred, we didn't know, have the evidence of how harmful it is, but we had the evidence about how harmful tobacco is for many, many years, and now the industry itself even admits that it lied for many, many years and knew full well that it was a very serious health hazard. So our hope is that our stand is that the tobacco industry should be held accountable.
But you're going to have to, if you are suing them now, you're going to have to prove, okay, smoking directly caused this health consequence for me. You can't just go in and say, we all know smoking is hazardous. We're just going to assume it had something to do with it. So are we going to see fewer cases, do you think, brought against the tobacco companies? Or this ruling could be appealed now, too.
No, I think we'll see more cases brought to the tobacco industry because they've put on their own websites that they know now that this is a lethal product. And it's the only legal product that you can buy over the counter that's lethal when taken as intended.
Dr. Seffrin, the court found that in building these cases about the general risk of smoking basically amounted to a ban on cigarettes, which Congress has said, you know, we're not going to impose that. But do you agree? Because then people are looking at, well, look, we've known for years that this has been a problem, and I'll let you answer that. But I think back to when Yul Brynner passed away, and then we saw this commercial that he had filmed before he passed away talking about the dangers of smoking. So this isn't anything new, but do you agree that Congress, they don't want to impose a ban on cigarettes, but what's your thoughts on that?
Well, my thought is that as regulators, congressmen have to understand that there's no choice but either to ban the product or to regulate it absolutely. The lethality of the product is over the top. There's nothing else we know. It literally causes one in every three cancer deaths here and around the world. And something has to happen. Something has to be done. Now, legally, it was tested in the courts, and Congress finally acted after 10 years. Now, FDA does have regulatory authority over the tobacco industry, and they need to move along very rapidly in regulating them absolutely. And part of that regulation means making sure everyone knows what the costs of tobacco smoking are.
Well, you mentioned what the costs are. Let's talk about the actual cost, because we've heard this issue time and time again in Georgia about raising the tobacco tax. Now, Georgia has the second lowest in the nation. And not just lawmakers, but lobbyists will say, well, you have to consider our retailers here. You have to consider that neighboring states, you know, we want that business here. Is this part of the answer, though, raising the tobacco tax, Dr. Seffrin?
Oh, absolutely. And it needs to be done not right away, but regularly. It's interesting. We know now, for the first time in the history of my organization, which is over 100 years old, for the first time in all of scientific, we know that if we do the right things, we can begin to talk about bringing cancer under control as a major public health problem in the United States and hopefully eventually around the world. But to do that, we have to do the right things. One of the right things that's worked every time it's been tried is to raise excise taxes on tobacco. It keeps fewer kids from getting addicted, and it motivates many adults to quit or cut back.
Is there data, though, to show that? In other words, is there data to show a direct correlation between raising tobacco taxes and cutting the rate of smoking, especially among the young?
Absolutely. No question about it. And there's what they call a price elasticity. So we know if you increase the excise tobacco's X amount, you get a Y impact in terms of fewer kids getting addicted. And that's been proven over and over and over in studies all around the world. So it works everywhere in the world where it's been tried.
Let's shift focus for a minute, because we've seen, really, in the time that you've been CEO even, dramatic drops in cancer deaths for most types of cancer. And in the last couple of years, there have been real huge advances in using what a lot of folks call targeted therapies against several kinds of cancer, sometimes even using disease agents like TB or polio to attack cancer cells. How far away are we, do you think, though, from seeing these in wide use? And even if they do come out, will people be able to afford them?
Well, those are several very tough, complex questions, but let me try to answer it the following way. The hopeful side of cancer has never been more hopeful than it is today. I believe that among all non-communicable diseases that are life-threatening, cancer is potentially the most preventable and the most curable today, if we do the right things. So we can prevent a lot of cancers by simply keeping people from getting addicted to tobacco. One of the most exciting things for me was to be in this chair at a time when we saw the advent of targeted therapies that you just mentioned, Dennis. And we funded Brian Druker his first year out of medical school with a small grant of $55,000 in 1985. And it was in 2001 that Gleevec was the second targeted therapy approved by the FDA. Those targeted therapies aren't the total answer, but they are improvements in treatment, and a subset of the patients who take those targeted therapies are truly cured.
Well, then the question is, okay, when they come along, will people be able to afford them? Because we have huge disparities now between people who can access care, even the existing therapies, and those who can't. Will people be able to access the new advances that are coming along?
This is a big concern of ours and many others. There's no question but what, in some cases, initially, they probably won't be able to afford it. The good news is, with the passage of the Affordable Care Act, however, preventive therapies that have been proven are automatically covered. So I'm optimistic, but it's going to be a challenge because many of those new drugs are quite expensive.
Dr. Seffron, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act and disparities here. So insurance is covering fewer treatments, and costs continue to go up. So obviously, you do believe the Affordable Care Act is making a difference. But if the Supreme Court throws out the tax credits here that are a part of it, will fewer people then be able to afford those treatments? And particularly, we're talking about low-income, underserved communities, people in rural communities here.
Absolutely. That's a very, very serious concern of ours. And one thing we need to recognize is that we are building out a new healthcare system. Not maybe, we are. we won't go back to what we had in the past. There have been 50,000 preventable deaths averted since the Affordable Care Act was passed because of people having access to care, fewer readmissions to the hospital and the like. 50,000 preventable deaths avoided just in that period of time. So it's not perfect. It needs to be tweaked and made better. But I think there's no question but what we will be able to become the healthiest nation in the world if we do the right things. And one of the right things that has to happen is that everybody needs to have access to quality health care when they need it and where they live.
And there are still disparities. I mean, we were just talking to Dr. David Satcher yesterday in terms about the disparity, particularly among the African-American community and other people, communities of color. What, in your time, what can you say, or how would you assess how the American Cancer Society has targeted, had specific campaigns for reaching the minority community about not just awareness, but about regular checkups, about participating in clinical trials? How would you assess how the organization has been able to do that since you've been ahead?
We've made a lot of progress, and we've done it basically in two different ways. One, boots on the ground. We're the only cancer-fighting organization in the not-for-profit sector that has a community presence virtually in not only every state, but all 435 congressional districts. So we have navigation programs where we go in to a particular area and actually train people who live there to help us get people aware of the tests that they need to avail themselves up. The other piece of this is just as important, though, is that we have a sister organization called the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, ACS-CAN, and we advocate to change policy because the ultimate conquest of cancer in this country is as much a public policy issue as it is a medical and scientific challenge, and disparities is a Dr. Broder, who was the head of the NCI a number of years ago, said poverty is a carcinogen. And he's absolutely right that a lot of people get sick and die of cancer simply because they're poor and don't have access to health care.
You mentioned tests, and that brings us to some of the big debates going on now over some screening tests for women and for men, especially mammograms for women for breast cancer, PSA tests for men for prostate cancer. And without oversimplifying, the arguments boil down somewhat to one side saying, look, these tests have saved lives, and you can certainly show that. The other side says, those tests have also meant unnecessary and at times dangerous surgeries for some people. So are we any closer to either consensus or maybe to some alternative approaches for these screening tests?
No, we're much closer to consensus. We're not there yet in every care. But let me give you three examples. First, the best one would be colorectal cancer screening. We at the National Press Club launched an effort a year ago, 80 by 18, to get 80% of the public compliant with our guidelines on colorectal cancer screening.
If that's colonoscopies, right?
That's colonoscopies, or we often say the best colon test is the one you get. So it doesn't. It can be other things, looking for occult blood in the stool. But the bottom line is to get screened. And we have guidelines about what you need to do that. And if we do that, and I think it's a stretch goal, but I think we'll make it, then we know when we've published how many thousands of more lives will be saved per year. So colorectal cancer screening is a no-brainer. There's a consensus. Mammography, too, saves lives. And we do need a better screening test, but it's the best we have right now, and it works, and the society will be coming out in days ahead with the new mammogram screening guidelines. And then, of course, the prostate cancer is the tough one, because the truth is prostate cancer death rates are dropping like a stone. That's a good thing. But we also know many people are being screened and treated who don't need to be treated, and that leads to a serious biomedical and ethical issue about we can't tell whether your prostate cancer is going to kill you or not yet. And one day we will be able to know which ones are innocent and which ones are lethal, and hopefully then we can treat the ones that are lethal.
Yeah, in fact, you even told me back in 2013 when we did a conversation for All Things Considered that even within your own researchers, one of your colleagues says he gets a PSA test every year, another absolutely refuses to get one, and these are people who know. So if your own experts disagree among themselves, how tough is it for the rest of us to figure out whether that PSA test is worth it or not?
It's a difficult thing, and that's why we just say that everybody needs to know that there is a test, and they need to consult with their physician and think about whether they want to have it or not.
Dr. Seffer, I want to move into funding, because with all the initiatives that you all are involved in and all the campaigns, that takes money. And a lot of funding obviously is needed for research, and treatment comes from major drug companies. And this isn't anything new, but are we seeing increasing conflicts of interest here? I mean, it seems like every other week or so we may hear in the news about some conflict between a drug company and you know, who's endorsing whom and so forth. What are we seeing here on that front?
Well, there's no question but what there have been conflicts of interest in the past, and there's much, much, much more attention being paid to it. I just had a conversation 2 days ago with an executive in a major pharmaceutical who said, you know, we're really much tougher on ourselves than we used to be, that when in doubt, don't go there. But conflicts of interest are inevitable in this area, and I think we just have to deal with them as they come forward. One issue that is extremely concerning to me is the fact that the federal government is systematically reducing the amount of investment in biomedical research. And that can slow down our progress dramatically. And we're advocating to try to increase that dramatically, because we now know we will get additional answers. There's never been a time in my life that investments in biomedical research have been a good investment. It's gone from a good bet when I started to a virtual sure bet today. And the slowing down of that is a great concern to the American Cancer Society.
You're the second outgoing CEO of an organization that we've had on this program this month. We had Dr. Helene Gale from CARE on earlier. I'm going to ask you the same question. I mean, I know y'all don't like to talk about legacies, but what has been the biggest satisfaction for you since you've been head of the American Cancer Society?
Well, I would have to pick number one is the fact that for 22 years in a row, the cancer death rates in America have gone down. And basically, that means that 1.5 million Americans will have a birthday this year that wouldn't have had if the cancer death rates had stayed the same as they were in 1991. So I guess because of the lives saved, and that's why the American Cancer Society adopted the slogan, American Cancer Society, the official sponsor of birthdays. But there have been many other things that have been very gratifying. The American Cancer Society stepped out in 2006, did something that no other voluntary health organization did, and that is called for health care reform. And my board asked me why we weren't doing better, even though we were making progress. And I said, there are three reasons that we aren't getting to our 2015 goals fast enough, 2015 goals. And one of those is lack of access to quality health care. And I said, we can't fix the healthcare system, but we are the largest voluntary health organization in the world. And they said, then we'll stand behind you. Let's step out and call for it. And we dedicated every nickel of our advertising budget the next year, 2007, to letting the American public see the broken healthcare system through the cancer lens. And these were real people. These weren't actresses and actors. These were people who had cancer who called us for help. And that moved the needle in terms of public attitude about, you know what, someone has cancer, they ought to be able to get treated.
But that brings up the question then of how partisan do you get in advocating? Because saying we need healthcare reform is a different thing from saying this model, the Affordable Care Act, for instance, is the way to go. Have you gone that far?
No, we have not. In fact, our bylaws for the ACS can say we are nonpartisan. We have not, nor would we, sponsor a candidate and do electioneering. But we also believe we have to take calculated risks and saying, you know, this is just not acceptable. And the truth is that the Affordable Care Act, because of its existence, put it this way, my wife is a breast cancer survivor. Before the Affordable Care Act passed, she could lose her health insurance because she had breast cancer. Before the Affordable Care Act, we had four-year-old children that had exhausted their lifetime cap for getting health care. Those things are now illegal. That's a wonderful thing. It should be illegal.
So what would you say then to somebody who's saying, okay, then you become an advocate for the administration and its model, as opposed to somebody saying, look, we just need to improve access however we do it?
And our feeling is that prevention's the best example. I had a call during the middle of that say, why aren't you talking more about prevention? I said, because both sides of the aisle agree that the new healthcare system has to emphasize prevention and keeping people healthy.
Dr. John Ceferin is the outgoing CEO of the American Cancer Society, which is based here in Atlanta. Dr. Ceferin, we could get into a lot more. Our time is up, but we really appreciate your being here.
Thank you.
Congratulations and best of luck in the retirement.
Thank you, Dr. Ceferin. We appreciate it.
Thank you.